Are we allowed to enjoy this?
Keane O'Mahony is literally an opposition scrum half's nightmare.
People say I refereed lots of matches when I actually played.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM
with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's move.
Sometimes all it takes is a new manager and all of a sudden everything's right in the world. You're very welcome along to Wednesday's OTB AM. It's Jarno with you all the way through until 10 this morning. We will, of course, be talking about the brand new era that started at Manchester United last night.
Mm-hmm.
What a stunning 2-0 performance. Always in control, never needed the goalkeeper to rescue anything for them, and away we go. Give it to Carrick till the end of the season.
The first English manager to win his first game for Manchester United since Walter Crickmer, who took charge of the club from 1937 to 1945. Of course, there have only been like three or four English managers in the entire history of Manchester United Football Club since then, but still, what a historic start for Michael Carrick.
When you think about it, it's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah, just got a huge affinity for Scottish people, basically, United, and nothing wrong with that. They brought some great success.
No, it's a very interesting football culture when it comes to producing world-class managers.
Yeah, so Wilf McGuinness, Dave Sexton, Ron Atkinson, they all managed to not achieve what Michael Carrick achieved last night, which was winning his first game as United boss.
Carrick is proving to be a better manager than he was a footballer.
Here we go. I'm interested to get Nathan's take on this morning. I mean, this is something that you've volunteered to wade into, Nathan, because this was yesterday's show, basically.
I volunteered to wade into, have I? on what? Michael Carrick, his greatness as a player?
Yeah.
I always thought Michael Carrick was a nice player, but I don't think they'd ever have called him a great player. I don't think he ever contributed enough. This feeling that he was more technical than a Gerrard or a Lampard, that English football couldn't appreciate a calibre, the technical ability of a player of a Michael Carrick, I think is a load of nonsense. He was a very nice, tidy footballer who had a great range of passing and played a key role in a very good Manchester United side, but not everybody needs to be a great.
Is he better than Jordan Henderson?
I think I don't think he's as important to his team as Jordan Henderson. I don't think he was as important, anywhere near as important to that Manchester United side as Jordan Henderson is to this Liverpool side. Skill wise,
is he better footballer?
Maybe he is. Maybe he is more talented. Maybe he has a better range of passing. But I think what Henderson gives to Liverpool and the way Jurgen Klopp wants to play is far more important than what Michael Carrick brought to that Manchester United side. And even in terms of the leadership that Henderson brings to that Liverpool side, never got the sense that was Carrick in United.
Yeah.
He must have thought when he got this job and somehow survived that, right, just get through day one, keep the head down, nothing too controversial. We'll just move on until the next interim manager comes in. And then Paul Scholes rocks up in BT last night and just chops the legs from under him before the game has even started.
Well, that's Scholes who's being stupid, right? That was an idiotic. Oh, they all should have resigned. Who was going to manage the team last night? Were you going to promote somebody from the youth team to take the team last night and, like, really make the search for the interim manager chaotic? What was his plan? Like, so when did Solskjaer officially go? When was the announcement came the day after?
Sunday.
Right. And there was a game on Tuesday that they had to travel to get to Spain. Who was going to pick the team? Were they going to make it maybe the subscribers to the app? There was going to be a vote on the app. What did Scholes want? It was ridiculous. Absolutely.
Well, maybe
ridiculous.
Darren Fletcher, who's not on the training ground every single day, who's a little bit removed from the
not on the training ground
management,
hasn't
team.
Seen any of the attitude on a day-to-day basis of the players, doesn't actually know what they're trying to do or what they're trying to achieve. It made absolutely no sense.
Is the problem
soundbite?
Carrick and McKenna are responsible for what they're trying to do and what they're trying to achieve, and that's why it's been this massive failure so far this season.
Maybe, but they did all right last night. You know, they made themselves slightly separate. They picked Donny van de Beek in a big game so he was picked in a big game in the Champions League before, and the red card meant that he didn't get his full opportunity to show exactly what he was capable of. They dropped Bruno. That hasn't happened very much. I don't know. I think Scholes was being fairly stereotypical curmudgeon Scholes, and he was wrong. And then ultimately the game was won last night.
Wasn't that a bit weird though? Like seeing the entire team just without Solskjaer on the sideline? Like, I mean, obviously, you're right in terms of the timing of it. You didn't have a lot of time to turn this thing around, but in an ideal world, would you not have had somebody else lined up and get the whole crew out of there?
Football is an old boys club, right? And has stereotypically, what we've been used to is the manager comes in and brings his mates with him because nobody on that coaching staff is ever going to challenge him. So that's what all the great managers do. Oh, they get all their own coaching staff in. Why is that? Why do we assume that that's the only way of doing business, as opposed to actually saying these are people who we know, who we've invested in, who we've built up over a long period of time, and who we think are very good coaches. The manager's going to come in and set the culture and tell them what they're supposed to be doing in terms of the structure of the training or what the philosophy of the training is supposed to achieve. Like, just there's this automatic kind of, you bring your mates in and everything's going to be grand and we'll pay them whatever you want to because you've got us over a barrel. Like,
It quite often works, though, doesn't it? You bring in a top-class manager, you get his backroom team with him who have worked with him in a previous...
Because footballism is, as we see, it is one of the worst-run industries where there are literally tens of millions wasted, pissed up against the wall for no specific reason other than that's how we do things in football. And there's no science. There's no science behind any of this.
What's your point, Jared, that... My point you should is that, be able to separate McKenna and Carrick, that this was all Solskjaer's fault and the coaching staff. Maybe we're actually geniuses in the background who are being held back and hampered by Solskjaer.
But it doesn't have to be binary like that, Nathan. They don't have to have been geniuses. They might just be as good. They might be interchangeable with loads of other coaches, except actually they're employees of the club. And I think Scholes was completely wrong. And I think the result bore it out, but I thought he was completely wrong beforehand. What the hell did he want? What did he want? He wanted a public sacrifice to feed his anger. And it wasn't enough for him that Solskjaer was humiliated the way he was. And, you know, he deserves to be because that's the game, that's the role, and he got amply paid for it. So I thought it was a ludicrous point from Solskjaer, from Scholes.
But, like, is it not reasonable to think that you can blame the last couple of years on more than just Solskjaer? Like, is that not his point? That actually...
Yeah, the players.
Entire, the entire coaching staff...
And the players.
You can't just get rid of the players.
Like, I mean, well, so how do you punish them? I don't know. I think this is a small tangent, right? But I do think that, like, it's grand for former players to... say what they want and to do the punditry, and that's what we want them for. We want them to say ridiculous stuff like this because ultimately we end up talking about it. But it is ridiculous. That doesn't mean I enjoy the fact that he is ridiculous in this instance, right? And like, that's fine. It's entertainment pre-match, but he was completely wrong.
I'm not
but
sure.
But you can't absolve Carrick or McKenna from blame for what's happened.
I didn't absolve them from blame, but I'm saying that, like,
but surely they have to take the same punishment as Ole Gunnar Solskjaer does.
Well, maybe the new manager is going to come in and they will also have to be compensated. But in the meantime, who was going to run things last night? It's a massive, massive game.
No,
you stick Fletcher in, who hasn't actually been at the training sessions week in, week out. Maybe he has been. Maybe Fletcher is at every single training session. I don't know. But I'd say Scholes doesn't know either. Like, and did he didn't even say, oh, put Fletcher in. He didn't say that. He was like, just get rid of everybody. They should have been so embarrassed by it. That's my point. We should move on. But go on.
No, it's fine. I'm not that passionate about this at all.
I just think
do an exit interview, Jer, basically is what I would suggest. Just get all their information and then say we'll pay whatever you want.
And who would pick the team?
Well, obviously, as I said, I think that in the
and who
context
gonna
of
sit
him
who's going to run over?
Days ago
say it's Fletcher, right? Who's going to run over to the fourth official? Is Fletcher going to do all that? Who's going to talk to the goalkeeper pre-game? Who's going to kick the ball out in and out to the goalkeeper in the warm-up?
I honestly thought on Sunday that there might be a possibility that Paul McShane might have a involvement, considering he's there with the 23s. That actually just a natural little step up for Paul McShane.
Well, maybe he'll end up working with Pochettino.
Possibly. If only Pochettino had a reason to be in Manchester this week.
I mean, do you think they just called over to the hotel, succession style, through the laundry
chute? Secret entrance, yeah.
Like, they are, right? If they're not doing that, they're doing something wrong. There must be a blacked out Chevrolet, which is in the underground car park, and they're just having a little chat going, do you like us? We like you. We really, really like you. Do you like us as much as we think you like us? They must be, right?
There's got to be a strong possibility this whole Pochettino story is just massive spin from Manchester United to show their weight and show that Well, Mauricio Pochettino would be willing to walk out on Messi, on Neymar and Mbappe mid-season because Manchester United are a truly great club. Not this new money of Paris Saint-Germain. We are a club that are bigger than everybody else, and even Messi couldn't keep him there. But actually, Pochettino's thinking, nah, I'll wait till the summer. I ain't walking on this project right now. And in the background, they're getting Ernesto Valverde.
That was left field. Mm. I'm interested in the thought process that brought them to Ernesto Valverde. I think that's just progress. You know? Like, it's better than Steve Bruce. Better than Mark Hughes. It's not as good as Wenger. I mean, it's just not as good as Wenger. Would have been the most trolling, interesting development ever. Although, he's exactly what they don't need right now with his laissez-faire. Ah, you guys go out and play. I'm not going to discipline anybody. Why would I do that? Life is too short. I don't know much about Valverde's style of play or how much of a disciplinarian he is. I know he was successful.
I think his outlook on life, Nathan, like, correct me on this, is a romantic one, more so than anything else. Whether or not that's actually replicated in his training ground methods, I'm not sure, because there was a big piece done with him in The Guardian during the summer with Sid Lowe, and the hook for the piece was Valverde releasing his own photographic collection, which was all football photos. So I'm not sure did he take them as he was coaching or as he was actually moving through his professional football life anyway, but he had this exhibition of photos taken of fans essentially outside grounds and the passion that exists in football.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Like he says, fans don't go to games to watch, they go to participate. I mean, that's something that could go down well with Manchester United fans. La vida a lo bestia, he says. Roughly, life only wilder, exaggerated, is his phrase about his photography tour.
Like, isn't it true, though, that he could actually wander unmolested through football fans in every country and people wouldn't go, oh, that's for Valverde?
100%. Really? 100%. Like, I mean, and like the CV is good. Like, I mean, with Athletic Bilbao, you could say he overachieved. He got Espanyol to UEFA Cup final. I think was he the last manager to have Barcelona at the top of La Liga as well? And maybe Liverpool is just this moment where, I mean, a couple of things go different over the course of those two legs, and maybe it's not a complete catastrophe in the context of his career. So I'm like, as you say,
only the same thing happened the season before.
Well, good point, I guess. But
it is that strange Spanish scenario for a manager where he absolutely dominates La Liga for the couple of years he's there, like goes on these mad unbeaten runs domestically again and again and again, wins back-to-back titles comfortably, but just two absolutely calamitous exits from the Champions League, or what he's probably best remembered for.
Wouldn't they bite your hand off now for that?
Well, the way he talks about the game and attractive football, and it might fit in perfectly with the Manchester United way between now and the end of the season, he feels like he's just slightly too big a name for the interim role.
Well, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
He may, if it were to go well, end up
getting the gig,
having to give him the job on the permanent basis.
Yeah.
What they want? Like, if they appoint Ernesto Valverde, does everybody in the boardroom put their feet up for 3-4 months and say, well, let's see how this goes, and Maurizio, we'll give you a shout in February, March, and if we need you, we'll take you, rather than, like, this is definitely happening next summer?
They keep getting hammered by the Man United fans that I follow on Twitter and just generally have been chatting to over the last couple of days about, oh, they don't have a clue what they're doing. And in fairness, they don't. We have established that. But to try and get your way out of this by just sticking Carrick in until the end of the season, that didn't seem like the right thing to do either, right? Like, I think finding an interim manager of that standard, that's pretty interesting. Like, that will certainly make everybody go, this guy might have a chance of getting the gig in the long term. So I can't just phone it in for 4 months. And we can't tank to get rid of him because, well, the hierarchy are going to see that we tanked. And also, we need to play Champions League football next season. And I'm sure they're bonused accordingly. So it's just the right amount of... I think you're right. And I don't think that's a bad thing when it comes to negotiating with Pochettino or whoever else they might be interested in the summer. It's like, well, take it, don't take it. You can't demand everything. This is the money. This is your backroom team. This is the transfer budget. That's it. We've got it. We've got a great manager who has turned things around. You know, like, they at least give themselves some opportunity to get out of this without looking like the complete idiots that they've looked like for the last decade.
He could become Manchester United's version of Goose Hiddink, the guy who, when we sack our manager, comes in for 4 or 5 months, who understands what Manchester United supporters want, good attacking football, but also we all in agreement that, like, this ain't your gig forever. So
Maybe he turns out to be Aaron Grant, though.
I think you need a Jose Mourinho before you can get a good sitting. Like, you need a, or at least a track record of Jose Mourinho's, or someone who's going to bring you titles. But it's a good chat. I wonder would he be happy. Like, the one thing from yesterday as well is, like, are we sure that Pochettino has kind of like said no to this initially? Like, I mean, so everybody's on the same page here. Like, I mean, he obviously said all the right things. Like, I'm happy at Paris Saint-Germain, I have a contract until 2023. But like this quote, like, football is today, football is not tomorrow, there is nothing in tomorrow. Of course the club need to plan and we need to plan, and we are working and thinking always about what is going to happen tomorrow, but football is about results. Like, I mean,
it's a James Bond movie title, isn't it?
It is. He's kind of thinking in the back of his head, should I just go? Like, he's weighing this up in the back of his mind, and he's clearly not overly happy, not overly delighted to be at Paris Saint-Germain. So that thing could still happen. But if Valverde comes in and does a really good job till the end of the season, that's not an interim, is it? Assuming he's happy to take the job on a longer term basis. If he impresses over the course of these next 5-6 months, he gets the job beyond the summer, doesn't he?
I don't know.
I think probably. Unless they publicly come out and in February or March and say they've come to an agreement, or Pochettino gets sacked after Paris Saint-Germain get knocked out in the last 16 of the Champions League, and they decide to make a change.
If Valverde was to do a Roberto Di Matteo here, right, and win the Champions League, hard not to give him at least 3 or 4 months next season.
It's a banker at that point. But like, here's the thing: if he has a good season over the course of the next 5 months,
what's a good season?
But Michael, say he like manages to break into the top three in the Premier League, for example, and Liverpool, Chelsea, or Man City finish behind them. From this juncture, I think it's a good spot, and also a European run, maybe quarterfinals in the Champions League.
Nah, I don't think that gets you the job. I think
semi-finals?
The only way you get the job is by winning.
Winning it? Okay.
Winning the Champions League.
I was just about to say that if Carrick and Valverde, if they're both put on the two different tracks and they both achieve the same thing, I think there's probably more of a tendency to give it to Valverde permanently than it would be to give it to Carrick, because there's just an exotic nature to Valverde coming in.
I think if Michael Carrick won the league and the Champions League, they would still struggle to give it to him just because of what happened the last time. Like, it's not just an
exotic nature to Valverde. As you said, you just went through some of Valverde's vast like experience. He's managed
an uninterrupted coach for 20 years.
He's won La Liga twice. He's got the Champions League semi-finals. He's been 3-0 up after the first leg of a Champions League semi-final. It's not comparing like with like when you're comparing him with Michael Carrick. The only reason you would ever think of giving it to Michael Carrick was he was a somewhere between grand and great midfielder for Manchester United 7-8 years ago.
Which is
exactly what they have just done.
Understands the Man United way, though, Nathan. It's very difficult for other people who have never experienced that on a day-to-day basis to know what that way is. It's obviously... it's like Sanskrit or one of those ancient languages that only the academics who have studied and have 15 degrees and 4 PhDs can actually get to the bottom of. Us mere mortals who are outsiders, we are on the outside of that giant flapping tent pissing in. And Michael Carrick is pissing out at us.
Well, unless they go to Stamford Bridge on Sunday and beat Chelsea 3-0 and suddenly Valverde's put in hold, Pochettino's put in hold, and wow, Ole was holding this genius on the sideline back.
We'd all be feeling the warm springs of Michael Carrick at that point.
We should talk about Chelsea in 1 second. OTBAM live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. It's a highly caffeinated trio you have with you this morning at 7:48. Here's what's coming up between now and 10 o'clock. Keith Wood's going to be joining us at about 10 past 8 this morning. Philippe Auclair. Well, give us the lowdown on the managerial merry-go-round that has to happen. There are a few more moving parts here about Zidane. Previously, we all expected Zidane to stay out of football until after the next World Cup was over, and then he would just swan in and take the France job for 4 years. But that might not happen. Conor McManus, Monaghan Football, are going to join us at 8:50. Jess Kelly is going to give us a gift guide at 10 past 9 this morning. And loads more coming your way, including Brian Kerr talking about his love of St. Pat's ahead of the Cup final this weekend. Now, let's talk Chelsea, right? Very quickly, some comments though. Jack Reaper on YouTube says Scholes is just bitter, crankiest man in football. Jose brought in Carrick and McKenna, just FYI. And Celtic Warrior on YouTube points out that was Moyes' problem at United. He got rid of all the backroom staff. I do think that there's probably a bunch of those players or a bunch of that backroom staff who do stay with the new manager in some role, because it looks like that's what Manchester United want to do in the future. Bonnie Hammer on YouTube says a manager has to have his own backroom staff. Yeah, he'll have some, but not like backroom staffs. When you think about the size of a backroom staff that the Tipperary hurlers or the Galway hurlers or the Dublin footballers are going to have, is Pochettino travelling with a crew of 20 he isn't. There is like a backroom. There is a
he has his little pal.
Yeah. There's a permanent staff. He has a little pal and maybe one other little pal. And they go off and they do their little jaunts together and they head the crack. And that's the inner sanctum. But everybody else is there making sure that the cones are in the right place.
Jesus Perez. Jesus Perez is his little pal, by the way.
Is it? Baby Perez.
Baby Jesus.
Virian on YouTube says, Jupp Heynckes at Bayern as interim won the treble and then was replaced by Pep. That was...
won the Champions League, yeah. Yep. 2012.
Jupp Heynckes. I'd say Jupp is like... Pep the genius. Oh, not so much of a genius now. Couldn't do it. Couldn't get the job done. Right. And Gary Egan says, love the show, guys. Thanks very much for that, Gary. Right. Let's talk about Chelsea. Last night...
when, they're very, very good.
Yeah. Timo Werner scored last night, Owen.
Yeah.
This is... Owen's been banging the Timo Werner drum since last season.
Yeah, this is...
He's going to come good. This is it. This is his bold, brave prediction at the start of the season. And last night, you know, good man to tap one in at 4-0.
Yeah, and at 95th minute... No, the Timo Werner take was very much a thinking out loud moment that just never made it to air. But my take, Nathan, was that there's a potential... There's a possibility that Werner could actually have a better season than Lukaku as the year went on. This was... What was the last game before Lukaku got injured in the Premier League? Do you remember he hit the post a couple of times and Werner... ended up scoring, did he, in that game? And I was like, you know what? He's going to be picking up the pieces a lot more this season. Obviously, he proceeded to get injured at the exact same time as Lukaku a couple of months ago, so his progress has been stalled. But they certainly have options. You can't really deny that up front, but it is possibly the weakest area when you're looking at that goal scorer when Lukaku's out, because the rest of the team looks awesome at the moment.
Yeah, but like, Lukaku costs $100 million, and your backups are still Timo Werner, Kai Havertz, Christian Pulisic, Ziyech, Hudson-Odoi. You just play in a slightly different way, as they have done. So I think, if anything, they have better backups than anybody else in pretty much every position. Like, watching them last night, and Chilwell and James looking like two of the best wing-backs in world football. Like, Marcos Alonso was probably the best right left-back in the Premier League for the first 6 weeks of the season and hasn't been seen for the last month. And Ben Chilwell comes in and does even better. Cesar Azpilicueta doesn't put a foot wrong. You know, great defender. Plays the first 6-7 games, hasn't been seen for the last month. Reece James comes in, scoring goals, contributing, looking like one of the best right-backs in English football. And they seem to have that in every part of the pitch. Like, I watched them against Leicester at the weekend. Can't really remember what the starting 11 was or who the substitutes were when they came on, because there's this constant flow of changing and it doesn't really make any difference who it is. They seem to be able to perform to the same level, and it does feel as though it puts them at a different level of consistency to both Liverpool and Manchester City. I think Liverpool and Manchester City's best might well be better than Chelsea's best, but they look like a team who are just going to win a lot of games against the, I won't say the lesser opposition, but everybody else. 2-0, 3-0, no fuss. Everybody fresh all of the time. And like, those players who scored the first three goals last night, all coming from the academy. The team last night, Chalobah from the academy, Reece James from the academy, Hudson-Odoi from the academy. You even look around the Premier League, Billy Gilmore's obviously gone to Norwich and may now get a bit of an opportunity under Dean Smith. We know how highly everybody rates Billy Gilmore at 18. Conor Gallagher at Crystal Palace, one of the best players in the Premier League so far this season, on loan from Chelsea. They've got 100 million quid in the summer for getting rid of three more players from the academy. Like, it just seems to be a never ending conveyor belt of talent at Chelsea at the moment, and now that they have the right manager as well, it's pretty frightening what they could do over the next few years.
Yeah, it's I mean, it would be pretty amazing if they'd kept some of the players that they have let go. You suspect they'll get better at scouting their own team and making sure that they don't let world class players go into the future, or if they do go, that there are buyback clauses inserted for the likes of Salah or De Bruyne or whoever.
Well, they've even done that this year. So Livermento at Southampton, the right back, who you know, brilliant, who I don't think anyone had ever really heard of. He hadn't played for Chelsea's first team. They put in a buyback clause for him, so they're obviously trying to do that. And even, like, I thought, of all their centre halves last season, that Tomori would be the one that would kick on and progress to the first team that they want to keep. But they sold him to AC Milan. You'd have to assume they put in a buyback clause there as well. Like, he's still a very young player. So you'd imagine they're pretty smart with these things now.
Is there, like, I mean, kind of being uber devil's advocate here, because I buy what you're saying. I know Joe maybe isn't drinking the Kool-Aid in Chelsea just yet this season, fully to the level that we are. But, like, just thinking about what could go wrong from this season, everybody knows exactly where Chelsea are going to hurt you at the moment. Now, they're pretty powerless to do anything about it when you've got those wing-backs playing like they're playing, but it is pretty obvious where they are going to hurt you. They are going to be their most potent attackers at times, especially when Lukaku is out injured. They're going to have the two midfielders that sit deep, the three at the back. There was clearly a Tuchel game plan that is going to be the game plan next weekend, next month, and all the way through till the end of the season. If there comes a point when that gets figured out, even just a little bit, it could be a situation where in a big game they do get figured out and they do fall away a little bit. That's the one thing that I could see potentially happening to them. Maybe not over this season, Nathan, but maybe over the course of the next couple of seasons.
Possibly, but like, look what they have in midfield, Kante and Jorginho and Kovacic, all of whom have raised their game massively since Tuchel came in. Like, they can overpower you in the middle of midfield. Just went through the attacking options, whatever rotation of those 6-7 players that they have, that even if they don't go with the wing-backs, even if they don't go through the wing-backs for absolutely everything, that they still have enough individual talent up front that somebody is always going to be able to create opportunities. Now, maybe the fact that they don't seem to ever really know what their best 11 is means that there is an opportunity for some inconsistency along the way. But yeah, the wing-backs have been absolutely vital. And like, Chilwell gets injured last night. You're not really in any way concerned because, you know, Alonso can come in at the weekend for the game against Manchester United. He tends to generally play very well against Manchester United, and they are key to everything he wants to do. But I think the rest of the team is so strong as well. Maybe could you question the defence? I know Thiago Silva was brilliant last night. Christian, Rudiger, Chalobah has come in.
They'll be grand. They're good enough to be like, grand.
Well, exactly. I still think that Liverpool and Manchester City have the ability to go on a run of being at their very, very best, and Chelsea may struggle to keep up with that, but like, they haven't really shown that consistency, Liverpool and Manchester City, over the last year or so, whereas Chelsea, since Tuchel has come in, they have.
One of the reasons I was a little bit sceptical was that I wasn't entirely convinced that Lukaku is like anything other than a flat track bully. I think he's a very, very good striker at that level, and there aren't a million of those strikers around. But actually, if you were to continue the pace of development that the forward players at Chelsea have and not play Lukaku ever, I think they're a more difficult team to manage against. There's loads of games you'll play Lukaku, he'll score twice, you'll win 2-0. But in those bigger games, like, would Man United, okay, maybe not Man United, would Liverpool or Man City really be able to deal with Lukaku? I think they probably will. But will they be able to deal with...
They have. Will they be able to... The games that have happened this season already.
Well, I mean, so into the future, right? Over the next couple of seasons, when you're looking at the evolution of Chelsea, the point you're making at the moment is that the very best, the highest level of City and Liverpool is higher than the highest level of Chelsea. And it felt like they weren't going to get to that same level if they were to put Lukaku in that side and then suddenly become quite a formulaic side who play to Lukaku's strengths. But if they have Kai Havertz and Pulisic and whoever else doing Havertz and Pulisic things and getting better at that, then I think that's more difficult to manage against and to prepare for into the long term than a very stereotypical English style centre forward that Lukaku is.
Or even just kind of like to add to that, is there sort of a different version that of a team that Lukaku fits into to get the best version out of Lukaku? It may not necessarily be the best version of the team for Chelsea, but if you look at, say, Conte at Milan last year, at Inter last year, it was Martinez playing alongside Lukaku. And that's kind of why I was excited about Werner at the start of the year, because I thought with Lukaku as the foil, he could have an explosive season. But it doesn't look like Tuchel might go for that just yet, and if he does, Werner will be playing kind of behind him in one of the almost an attacking midfielder position. That it does seem he's more likely to go with like Havertz and Mount and attack alongside Lukaku than his classic buddy cop system up front, which would have got the best out of Lukaku last season, for example. And I just wonder, is he going to be a bit isolated in this Chelsea team and maybe not produce the massive attacking returns that he produced at Inter over the past little while?
Well, he hasn't so far. That game against Liverpool was a repeat of his performance for Manchester United a couple of years ago, where Van Dijk didn't have to even tackle him. He just couldn't get himself involved in the game. Their performance against Manchester City was probably their worst of the season so far, and Lukaku started both of those games. And you're right, that is trying to figure out those pieces of the attacking positions. Like, how do you play Pulisic, who I think is maybe the best of all the attackers? How do you play him and Mount, the best of all the midfielders, in the same team if Lukaku's there as well? So maybe there's just enough rotation that everybody's kept happy all of the time. But when Lukaku was fit, he was playing every single game. And you're suddenly trying to keep Pulisic happy, Ziyech happy. Hudson-Odoi seems to be particularly happy when Lukaku's there because he's not getting his game at all. So like maybe that is the one area where you're right, that if Lukaku's playing all the time, is it actually taking something away? But then I think that flat track bully against everybody outside the top six will work just fine for Chelsea and Romelu Lukaku. It's a hard thing to do, though, if he's scoring goals against them.
To leave him out in not the Champions League semi-final.
In the biggest games.
Yeah, it
exactly.
is. It is. And so that's like, I mean, we are nitpicking here because we have three very, very, very good teams in the Premier League. There are inconsistencies in Liverpool in particular that I must be maddening for Klopp to get out of, because his team is definitely capable of playing the best, most explosive periods of matches. You can see Man City being the best for 90 minutes, but you can still see Chelsea winning the title by virtue of the fact that they just beat all the teams who you're supposed to beat, and then they do well enough in the other games over the course of the season to break even or just be a little bit behind, and away you go, game over, right?
Yeah, and that's sort of what's happened so far. We have weekends like last weekend where they just brush Leicester aside, and Leicester obviously aren't what they were over the last couple of seasons. But suddenly, both Liverpool and Manchester City are going into their games under a lot of pressure because Chelsea have opened up a little bit of a gap. And if Chelsea go and beat Manchester United, which you probably expect they're going to this weekend, like, that pressure keeps ratcheting up on Liverpool and Manchester City, that they just cannot slip up. And that's the sort of title race we've seen in England consistently over the last few years, that if a team gets a run, it's very hard to stay with them and they end up just sort of running away with the title. So Liverpool, as we know, in January are going to lose Mo Salah and lose Sadio Mane, and Manchester City still don't have a striker. So like, there's a huge opportunity here for Chelsea to go and get a nice little lead by the time we get into January, February.
Yeah, it's been interesting so far. If you want to get involved in the conversation this morning, 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. You can always get us on Twitter at OffTheBallAM as well. AskNieres32, maybe it's a backward spelling or something, is it? It has to be on an interim basis. Get the lad you want in next summer. If Valverde does better, then, well, Newcastle will come looking for him if they stay up. I mean, having a Valverde in our lives after this is going to be good for us anyway, one way or another, right?
Why?
Well, it sounds like he's a good, interesting manager with a slightly different take on life. I mean, he's certainly more interesting than insert cookie cutter manager of any of the last six Watford managers, or any of the Chris Wilders of the world who flattered to the sea for 18 months.
Which do you think will be a more important factor in predicting Ernesto Valverde's success through the prism of the English media? Do you think it'll be 20 years of uninterrupted coaching where he has overachieved the likes of Athletic Club Bilbao and Espanyol, or the two games where he had a bad time of it in the Champions League, in which one of them was an English club involved?
If he gets beaten 4-0 at any point, then I suspect that the latter is right. Very quickly, we need to cycle through some of the other big stories. We were talking golf last week. What's Rory McIlroy doing pulling his shirt off? What's going on, Nathan? What's going on?
I don't know what is going on, and it feels like there's always something going on with Rory at the moment. High highs, low lows. Put himself in contention at the DP World Tour Championship, where he's won twice already. So we've seen with Rory, when he's comfortable at a course this year, he's able to play his best stuff, sort of despite what his form is. And you think he's going to kick on, he's going to win this event again, and it's a nice end to the season. And while it doesn't fix all the woes that went on at the Ryder Cup and the majors, again, we go through that nice Christmas winter spell, we're thinking he's going to go to Augusta in a nice little bit of form, and then has a really bad bit of luck right towards the end of the round. Sure, you saw this, where it hits his approach, it hits the flag, ends up in the bunker, ends up taking bogey. And Colin Morikawa, who is just the calmest man in the world, just cruises on in and wins the tournament. And then there's a photograph of Rory with his shirt ripped. I don't think I've ever seen a golfer rip his shirt to pieces.
Not great advertising for sort of the quality of
Hulk Hogan style. Hulk,
yeah.
Like, maybe he's just been working out and was like, haven't had an opportunity to take my top off here at any stage. And I'm just going to show everybody what Rory McIlroy is about right now. But there's no way Rory... Or he doesn't know that that's going to end up being seen, and questions are going to be asked. And like Justin Thomas is coming out saying, yes, this is what you'd be loving, Rory. He shows an emotion, but you know, it just feels there's no need. Like, you didn't win the golf tournament, you had a little bit of bad luck. Move on. But there's obviously a lot of frustration in there. We go from the tears at the Ryder Cup to the ripping the T-shirt.
Yeah, it is a roller
coaster. It does feel as though he's not in a particularly good place right now. And
but he was
really
sensational on the Thursday.
It's getting away from him.
Like, really sensational on the Thursday. You know, playing some of the best
he
golf.
He was, but and he's been sensational several times this year. Like, when he won at Quail Hollow, he's been sensational. A few weeks ago, when he won the PGA Tour, he was sensational. Like, when it's coming, it feels like when it's coming easy to him, like, he can still be sensational. But these are all on courses where he knows the course backwards and he feels very comfortable.
Right.
So it's doing it when you're not comfortable. And
so the,
again, like, what do you advise Rory? Go away and don't play for 3-4 months and get that bit of balance that he seems to be searching for? Or does he need to go and grind on the range again now that he's finished up with Pete Cowan? He's back with Michael Bannon and working
back to
his
Ireland.
Range game.
Move back to Ireland. Go to the games at Ravenhill on a Friday night and have the crack and see the benefit of your money on the team. We I think spoke, or maybe we didn't, about the renaming of the European Tour as the DP.
DP World Tour chair.
Yeah.
So I know you're excited about it.
I know the name of the company, but it kind of has other connotations. The money that comes from that obviously is great for the European Tour. We've seen the Saudi interest ratchet the pressure up, and all of a sudden the PGA Tour managed to have a little rummage down the back of the couch and find an absolute massive amount of money that they're going to give to the players next year.
Well, Rory McIlroy's key to this as well. We touched on Rory, how strong he was against the new Premier Golf League and Saudi money coming into golf and the opportunities that were being presented and potentially a guaranteed 40, 50 million for every player. Rory is the head of the Players Advisory Council, which he's by far and away the most high profile head of the Players Advisory Council. And he is the PGA Tour's best asset right now. But this Saudi money has finally given the players leverage. And boy, are they using it. So we saw this come in already with the PIP program, which is basically 40 million for the 10 most well-known players with the biggest profiles as sort of imaging rights for them. So that's being handed out at the moment to, I presume, Rory McIlroy will be one of them. And now the PGA Tour have had to respond to this because players, I think Phil Mickelson was one of them, questioning, well, what is the revenue and where is all that money going? So the PGA Tour sent out a memo last week to all their players outlining where it's going. So their revenue is $1.522 billion for next year in 2022. They've just signed this billion-dollar deal with NBC, which is just starting this year. $716 million in expenses, which leaves $806 million available for player prize money. They're going to take another $32 million from the reserves to add to that. So next year, they're going to be playing for $838 million in prize money. The FedEx Cup bonus pool is now $75 million. I didn't realize the FedEx Cup bonus pool goes all the way down to 125th. If you keep your card, you're getting a bonus at the end of the season as well for keeping your card. So we look at the Players' Championship and the winner gets $15 million. That actually continues all the way down. So even if you're finishing 115th, you're getting a couple of hundred grand as a FedEx bonus. So that's gone up from $60 million to $75 million. The Player Impact Program, which I just touched on, which is money for old rope for the best players, up to $50 million from $40 million. Expect that to keep rising and rising and rising.
Yeah.
And then in looking at some of the tournaments, so the Players' Championship is now going to be worth $20 million, was $15 million, and even that has jumped massively over the last couple of years.
Right.
World Golf Championships are up to $12 million. The FedEx Cup Playoffs, winning a FedEx Cup playoff now, up on $15 million. So the money is insane and they don't have to do anything. They don't really have to leave America only a couple of times a year. They don't need to commit to a round-the-world tour where they have to play 30 times. If you're one of the 10, 20 best players in the world, you'll do just fine on the PGA Tour.
And you're going to continuously have the opportunity, a la the Irish rugby players, just going to France for a week and kind of hanging out with whoever it was. That's what they can do. Oh, I'm just going down to Saudi Arabia to see what they're doing. I'm just playing a bit of golf.
Well, that's exactly what happened. They'll still play their 5-6 events. And I remember Paul McGinley talking about one of the big draws of the PGA Tour is clearly the money, and they need to keep pace with what has been offered elsewhere. But when you have that much money, players don't want to travel. They don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be told,
no,
actually, we've just signed a new deal and we're going to Australia for a 3-tournament deal in December and say goodbye to your family.
I need to go,
Tough
Nathan.
Luck.
But Colin Boyle's retirement, it's the end of an era.
It's constantly an end of an era. But here, we can counter it with the news that Oisin Mullen, it seems, may not be going. No contract has been signed yet, and reports in Mayo that maybe Oisin Mullen may not be going.
Really? This is, you yes. buried the lead here. This is, I think this will be the biggest. Well, it's been a season of massive off-season stories. Are you just reporting rumor here?
Yes. Well, listen, I think we need to build some momentum.
I did.
No contract has been signed. Local media reports in Mayo, and it serves them right after what they did to us here and off the ball, cutting out the bit where he said it would be a disaster for Mayo for Oisin Mullen to leave. And Geelong put up their little video as if we thought this was the greatest thing of all time. Well, let's wait and see what happens. But yes, Colin Boyle and Colin Boyle's big shoulders will be badly, badly missed.
Right, but if Oisin Mullen is staying, that is the best news that Mayo have had since they beat Dublin
without
in the semi-final. Fair enough. Okay, so it's not that long ago. But it would be a monumental moment if whatever happened prevents him from going or keeps him in Mayo. That's a massive breakthrough.
He's glad it happens.
Right. Nathan, good stuff. Thanks very much for that.
Thank
We're going to hear from
Thank
Nathan
you.
Again. The Republic of Ireland versus Slovakia. He's on commentary duty for that on Thursday night. Big, big game. It looks like they're trying to get a record crowd in Tala for the women's team. And he'll be back for that. We'll be bringing you pre-match analysis of the Republic of Ireland women's national team against Slovakia as well. That is today's Wednesday. Tomorrow at 11 minutes past 8 this morning, we're going to take a quick break and we're back with Keith Wood.
OTB AM.
It's 12 minutes past 8 this morning. You're watching OTB AM. Perhaps you're listening to us on the OTB Sports app on OTB Sports Radio. Either way, you're very welcome and we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment in the YouTube stream. We're turning to rugby and I'm delighted to say Keith Wood is with us. Keith, how are you?
I'm excellent, Chair. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm disappointed that Stephen Larkham is leaving, to be honest. It felt like I wanted to see what he was going to be able to do with a fully fit Joey Carberry and all of the available talents to him. Imagine Carberry and Diallende finally, Carberry fit and in form and Diallende finally just around. It'd be nice to see what he could do, but we're never really going to get that opportunity. So was this news a surprise in the end to you? Did you know it was coming? What did you think about it?
Yeah, I didn't know it was coming. I knew there were some doubts with it, but didn't know that it was coming. It came as a shock that that news arrived so early. I think it's a huge pity, actually, because we never got the chance to see what this guy could be. I mean, he was a maestro on the field when he played himself. Broke my heart on numerous occasions. He had a lovely ghosting attitude to playing at 10. Where he could play to a structure, but it was when there was one tiny little chink in the defence, he would go off and do something very differently. He ran very differently, you know, he's quite a tall guy for 10. And I felt at times that that's something that might fit into Joey Carberry's remit, that the ability to make a decision on the fly that wasn't part of a structure is probably what marks him out. And I think we saw a bit of that last weekend. So, look, I think it's an awful pity. I don't know that we got to see the best of him. Personally, I'm still not convinced of the manner in which Munster are playing. I think it's too slow down, too structured, too akin to the South African game, if I'm honest. And it would be interesting to see whether there's a change. And that's the one bit I would look for after last weekend the last few weekends, is that we've seen a team that has consistently gone about making a change in Ireland in how it's run through a whole variety of different ball players, and whether Munster will look to do something like that or stay with the manner in which they're doing. And I think that comes the big challenge. And for that to really work, I think an awful lot of that would have gone through someone like Larkham. So with him, he's there and will be there till the end of the season. But as we know, and we've seen with Ireland, it doesn't happen over a short period of time. It takes a much longer period of time to make those sort of changes.
Okay, that's interesting, because they definitely have the players who can play a style of rugby that would be different from the South African style of rugby. And I can also see that they have the players who can play the South African style of rugby too. So do you feel a little bit like they're caught between the two stools at the moment?
I'm not sure. I don't think Munster are as big a pack of forwards. And I think your requirement for... If we look at South Africa's rugby, and I know there was a huge amount of criticism, and it is consistently, but it's their way of playing. Let them play it. They play it very well. They kick quite a lot. They have a huge forward pack that they use very well. They have a 10 that kicks from distance, but also boots the ball in the air quite a lot. And the second, there's a chink. And in most cases for South Africa, when there is an advantage from a penalty, they will try everything and anything. And they have two unbelievably quick guys on the wing. The problem with that is it's quite attritional on the body. You need to be very big for that to be repeatable. So, and at times when we've seen Munster change, it's been the younger guys that have made that change. And that's, we've seen that this season. But it's when they reverted back, they haven't quite got to the level of performance. And that's why I've been really interested to watch the Munster players play for Ireland over this period of time, because they have all embraced it. Maybe not all, actually, but most have embraced it. And you've seen Craig Casey come on off the bench the other day and suddenly play like he played when he came on the scene, which was an all-action game. Get to the ball first, get it off the ground, get it out of your hands as quickly as you can, and let other people make some of the decisions. And so, look, I do think Munster can. I just think it takes a period of time. And I'm hoping that that's part of the journey that they're on, because the kicking in the air and one-out runner game had its day, but it has had its day.
We obviously are looking at the Larkham decision through the prism of what's going to come next in terms of Johan van Graan. There's been strong suggestions that he's on the verge of signing another extension to his contract. So it'll be interesting to see if that happens, first off, and if it does, who he hopes is added to that coaching ticket, and ultimately who's making that decision. Is that are the IRFU involved at any level in saying, actually, we have young rising Irish coaches who we think would fit there, or does it have to be somebody who is simpatico with the existing ticket?
Well, I don't think any decision happens at that level without going through a David Nusafora filter. So the IRFU will be heavily involved in that decision, and whether it is about bringing Irish guys back. I know they were talking about Prendergast coming back from France. Whether that's in the offing or not, I don't know. But I would like to see some more Irish coaches get involved, because I think that that's important for the game. It's important also for the guys that are coming to retirement that there are viable options for them to still be involved in the game afterwards. And because you want that level of continuity, and you want some of the skills, as we've seen, I think, with Paul O'Connell with Ireland. It's having the right job for the right man, or the right man for the right job, or whatever way you want to put it. But he has had huge success in terms of the attention to detail from the forwards, and I think it's a role that suits him perfectly. So I do think that there is a need for some of those players or past players to get back into the game, or even some of the other coaches, because then we're talking about Noel McNamara, who cut his teeth with Glenn Stahl and then went to Leinster and is now down in South Africa. Look, for me, an awful lot of this comes down to philosophy, and it's what we talked about for Ireland for the last few weeks. It was refreshing to see the game being played differently. And look, do you know what's an interesting thing this morning is that we're not talking about Johnny Sexton. And if you think of all the chat prior to the autumn internationals, it was about Johnny, and it was all about Johnny and what do we do and where can he go? And we're all saying, well, it's too much of a risk for him to go to the World Cup. Well, it doesn't seem like a risk now, 4 weeks later, because not everything goes through 10, and not everything goes through the sort of genius that Johnny Sexton was in the past, where he has to make every single decision. Now that is a shared load. And then you can say, when that happens, well, actually, he could well get to the World Cup, because if he gets injured, which he has done a fair bit, that other people can fit into that role. It's just very few could have fitted into the old Johnny Sexton role.
Talk us through that a little bit then, Keith, when it comes to the different playmakers that Ireland have on the pitch. Has it completely exploded now to the sustainable thing where you're looking at 5-6 players on the pitch that can be the creative spark for this Ireland team?
Well, for me, it's A, the philosophy around it, B, the structure of all the 3 or 4 or 5 different options. And those options, they come off 9 or 10, or they come off a pivot off one of the forwards, but the decision making is made by 9 or 10. But it isn't made like an old traditional setup where you just hit the 10 and everything kind of works off 10. And if he takes it flat to the line, he's an opportunity of finding a hole. And that's where Johnny was getting smashed. And if he takes it too deep, nobody puts any pressure on him. And they all go out and put pressure on 12, 13, and the ball doesn't get to the wing. For me, this seems like almost a natural way of doing it. So people make a decision, but there's two or three or four options nearly for every ball that goes out there. And it's played as being what's the right option. I don't know if that's true, but that's what it looks like, that they're not all preordained, or there may be a preordained call, but you also have two or three bailout options if you need it, if they're a better option, or if you need to protect a player. And so for that, I thought Joey Carberry came into it, against New Zealand, and I thought he was a little bit nervous into it, and I thought he built up his confidence. And then I saw him against Argentina, and again I thought he was a little bit nervous at the start, but he grew into it, which is for a guy who has had huge injury and hasn't had lost a bit of confidence. I think he gained a huge amount of confidence back. And then when Harry Byrne went in there, Joey slotted into 15, and we know that with more time on the ball anyway, he is explosive and he will take up decision-making process, which it just looked far, far better, far more energetic and far harder for a defensive line-out to target. I say all the time that if you're playing against Ireland, have a hard press defence, 7, 10, 12, 13 up against the Ireland defence, and that puts Johnny Sexton under huge pressure. And if he takes it flat, he's under pressure. If it's too deep, you can push out on everybody else. You do that now, and anybody has any doubt in the defensive line, because there's so many options, there can be chinks. Doesn't mean you're going to win everything, but it means the opposition now really have to think about what they're doing. They don't just have to smash up in the line. And so I think the onus is on more people, more players. And for me, that was the most heartening element of the whole thing. I looked at Japan and thought Japan was thought Japan were dreadful. And I didn't get too excited by it because I thought there was too much space on the field. But then in the next 2 weeks, with not the same players, there was more space again, because that hard press became very difficult for an opposition to do. So, look, I just thought it was a cracking autumn for Ireland, and it's a great start for where we can go afterwards. And look, we won't fall into the idea that everything is rosy in the garden, but all you have to do is think and listen to what the players have said about the level of enjoyment that they're having. Well, of course you're going to have enjoyment. Of course you're going to have enjoyment in something like that, Ger, where you're given an option to make a decision. So for different times over the last, like the really successful side under Joe Schmidt, everything had to be perfect and absolute precision. And I think we will look for more precision, but I hope we never lose the sort of joy of playing and the ability to throw a 50-50 pass because it's the right thing to do, or the idea that you should try something and you should never be castigated for trying something. So that's what it looked like, and I think it's a fairly significant change.
You mentioned there, Keith, the high press, the hard press, and I guess that line speed that decimated Ireland and it caused them real problems in 2019 onwards. What do you expect the reaction to this style of play to now be going into next year's Six Nations?
Well, I think if you look at it, firstly, the reason it put Ireland under so much pressure was pretty much everything came off 10. So it was either box kicked or came off 10. So that's where the pressure point lay. And that's where the vulnerability lay. And I think we said this a few weeks ago, it wasn't the criticising of Johnny Sexton, it's the criticising of the fact that we didn't have other options. Well, we seem to have the options now because we're trying to play a different style. So what's going to happen and how are other coaches going to unpick that? That's where, for me, that's going to be the enjoyable part to watch, to see whether other people try and unpick us. And this is the right time for us to learn what things work and what things don't work. But also how opposition coaches go about it. So there can be, it used to be a 13 hook where it would be a really hard press up at 12 and 13, but that then goes to the kick pass and that goes for the pass over the top. But that can be exploited again. Look, for me, this is working for us for a couple of reasons. One of them is the law change. The 50-22 has made a big difference, that you have players standing further back and having to stand further back. So there is slightly more space in the defensive setup. So there are other opportunities if you're able to change an angle or if there's other ball handlers. And a tip-on is the hardest thing of the lot. There's also the tackle heights coming down. That's incredibly important. If you're tackling across the shoulder line to stop the ball, there are very few tip-ons in that instance. So that that risk of giving away a penalty at that is freeing up the game as well. So if this happens every 4 years, where there are changes and adjustments to the laws, where it's the coaches deal their way out of it. So I think Ireland have moved not ahead of the curve, but they've moved in a fashion of where they're a bit more comfortable to be footballers to play.
Yeah, and the skill level is very high of the new generation of players who are coming through as well. We see them very comfortable on the ball. One last question to wrap this up, Keith. The style that we've watched over the last few weeks, and to bring this right back to Larkham, does this actually increase the pressure then on Van Grand to make sure that the style that the Munster supporters watch and the players get to execute is more progressive over the next while? And is that maybe one of the most interesting narratives over the next couple of months for us to keep an eye on?
Well, I actually think that's a really good narrative. And I also think, and if we take the two scrum halves that played on Saturday, the younger guy, so Casey came on, and it was immediately zip, 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 zip. And I actually think that's how he plays best. It suits him. And that's how he started with Munster. And he's had to move back to a box kicking and kind of slow it down, because that's the way Munster play a lot of the time. Not all of the time, but a lot of the time. And I thought he relished it and looked fantastic. For Conor Murray, I thought he didn't relish it. And I thought he box kicked too much early on, as if that wasn't... and that wasn't always the way he played either. So... But under the way Munster play, Conor Murray suits them down to the ground, not Craig Casey. And but under the way Ireland play, Craig Casey's style suits Ireland. And then it's up to Conor to be able to adjust between the two, and Craig to be able to adjust between the two. So I think the change at national level puts huge pressure on Munster. Do they continue in the manner in which they're going, or do they embrace that one performance that they had away to Scarlets, where the ball in the hand and the width and the different players presenting themselves at different times seemed to offer a level of excitement? But the only thing I would say after that was that was a big change in the manner in which Munster play, and most of those players didn't play the following week.
Okay, we'll keep a very close eye on the brewing scrum half controversy. Keith, great to have you with us. Thanks a million.
Brilliant. Cheers, gents.
Keith Wood giving us his thoughts there on the rugby scenario. Give us your thoughts. If you're a Munster fan, we'd love to hear from you. The hashtag is OTBAM, or of course you can leave a comment on the YouTube stream. It's 29 minutes past 8. I want to tell you about this, because over the next couple of days we're going to start releasing content from our next Cadbury FC Roadshow. And if you're an Arsenal or an Ireland fan, then you don't want to miss it. We'll go behind the scenes with the Arsenal invincible Robert Pires. We'll speak with current Gunners and Ireland captain Katie McCabe. We'll also be joined by former Arsenal strength and conditioning coach and Ireland rugby legend Gerry Flannery. Great conversations about what it's actually like, just the very presence of Liam Brady on the training ground and the impact that would have on training sessions for the academy. It's really interesting to hear Gerry Flannery talk about that. It's all with thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs, coming soon to OTB Sports social channels. Now, we're going back to the Champions League. I'm delighted to say Philippe Auclair is with us. Philippe, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
There's lots to talk about, and we'll talk about Qatar in a moment, but I want to talk about the Champions League and your instinct about the managerial merry-go-round that is happening at the moment. Is this a carousel that doesn't stop until Zidane is in Paris and Pochettino is in... or is that a...
Well, nothing happens.
Yeah, because everything is possible here, right?
Absolutely, everything is possible. It's been a bit wild over the last few days because on one hand, we've had... information that Mauricio Pochettino was on about to sign a contract extension with PSG. Some people understood that as being putting pressure on possible suitors like Manchester United so that they would have to pay more compensation. Then Zinedine Zidane is talked about as being the next PSG manager, which to people who have followed the story for a while would be very surprising. Zidane has never shown the least interest in going into that madhouse that is PSG at the moment. And also, according to people who are close to him, he would like to wait until next summer before deciding on which turn his career is going to take. He will have just turned 50. He's got time on his hand. He's also got the prospect of perhaps taking over from Didier Deschamps after the 2022 World Cup, which is avowed ambition. And so there is no reason for him to, you know, to press matters and to join PSG, especially where they are at the moment. And I have to say, from a French point of view, it all feels like there's a lot of what is missing outside when we're looking outside our window, which is hot air around what is happening there. Because it starts from this premise that Manchester United is a club that you cannot refuse, and which is, of course, a conception, an idea, a concept, whatever you want to take it, but not necessarily a reality. And at the moment, despite the chaos in Paris, and there is a measure of chaos in Paris, it looks as if everybody's going to stay exactly where they are right now.
That's very interesting, because the assumption is that Pochettino will take this feeling like he has to take it now or it might never come for him again. But when you're on that carousel of managing the super clubs, you can go and, you know, he could easily manage a super club in Spain, whichever one becomes available at some point in the near future, almost irrespective of what happens in Paris Saint-Germain. It's not that it seems like you can escape Paris Saint-Germain because everybody understands the chaos, with your reputation not damaged, not necessarily enhanced, but everybody goes, well, that's just Paris Saint-Germain. It's very difficult exactly. for anybody to manage there.
Which is what's happened to Thomas Tuchel, you know, who is having an absolutely phenomenal season, or I should say, second season at Chelsea after being sacked by PSG, which is a decision that has certainly come back to bite them. And for Pochettino, I mean, I'm not saying that Pochettino wouldn't relish the chance to go elsewhere because he's had so many problems. And to be honest, I really thought last summer that we might have seen the last of Mauricio Pochettino at PSG. And I think we actually touched upon that because his relationship with Leonardo is completely broken. The sports director, that is Leonardo, of PSG. And he's finding it very difficult. And he's actually starting to talk about that, about what is expected from a PSG manager compared to what he's had before, you know, be it with Espanyol or Southampton or Tottenham. And basically, he has to take care of the whims of his players, some of his players. He's got also to toe the line as far as his owners are concerned. The chain of command at PSG is very, very complicated to explain. And to be honest, it's at times you wonder if there is one. But the manager basically has got to do what he's told to do. And he has very, very little leeway in the way he goes about his job. And there is no doubt that if an offer came for Pochettino at the right moment, he would take it. I mean, his contract runs until 2023. The compensation, should he break that contract, is certainly not something that is out of reach for most big clubs in Europe. We're talking about 9.5 million euros salary. So if it were to happen now, you're talking about something like 12 million euros compensation, which honestly for clubs like Manchester United is small change. But it's not that which matters. What matters is that at the moment, it's not something which... I mean, everything is possible in football, and it's possible that the one person who's going to be bitten is going to be me in 24 hours. It's completely possible. But at the moment, PSG haven't got a replacement lined for Pochettino. They are in the last 16 of the Champions League. They are running away with the French League, which, by the way, if Pochettino left now, he would leave PSG with as a trophy, the only trophy, a Coupe de France, a French Cup. I think that there is something in Pochettino who would quite like the idea to finally have this major title on his honours list, which is a title of French champion, albeit with PSG after what happened last season and Lille and won the title. I don't think that, you know, the prospect of winning a title with PSG is something that is necessarily repulsive to Mauricio Pochettino. You put all these things together and you think, well, why would he leave really now? And also, Manchester United, maybe I'm very naive, but Manchester United were, for once, were very clear in their statement when they decided to part with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Michael Carrick is taking over as a caretaker. Hasn't had too bad a start, by the way. Then they will have what the Italians call a traghettatore, which is the ferryman to take them to the end of the season, which is, I think, a perfectly rational decision. People are now talking about Ernesto Valverde, who is certainly not a bad coach, a bad manager. He's shown that in quite a few clubs, be it Atletico or Barcelona. There might be other people as well who could do that job. And then we take a big breath and we decide on something in May or June. I mean, you can talk now with the people you'd like as your permanent manager, but you make the appointment in May or June. That would be completely rational. But I think that our hunger for big news, because it's Manchester United and PSG, is such that we're kind of willing these things to happen. And the rumours are circulating quite wildly at the moment, despite the fact that some of them might not have any foundation in reality.
You talk about the complicated nature of those working above Pochettino at Paris Saint-Germain. You mentioned the relatively complicated dressing room as well. It's not an easy dressing room to manage. How different would Manchester United be to that, really, given the dressing room at play there, and also this sense that the Manchester United hierarchy kind of liked having Solskjaer as something of a puppet over the last few years?
Oh, it's certain that if you got Mauricio Pochettino, you wouldn't get a puppet, especially the Mauricio Pochettino after PSG, who will definitely not want to be a puppet anymore. Even he's not quite a puppet, by the way, in Paris. It's just that he doesn't have the leeway he would like to have. Well, I think managing a team like PSG at the moment, when you've got Neymar, who was having fun in Brazil before rejoining the team, Lionel Messi, who's finally scored at Parc des Princes, and but whom I'm told already is talking about leaving and going to Miami, which is one of the destinations you will remember that were mentioned when he left Barcelona, but apparently he's not too happy there. Kylian Mbappé, who is not happy at all, and everybody knows about that, even though he's in a fantastic form himself. I think he's now... He's scored 44 goals in the calendar year, which is the second highest total in Europe, only behind Robert Lewandowski, or Super Lewandowski, who's got 64. So you've got three unsettled players there. You've got a team that is working without working. You've got, don't forget that also Nasser Al-Khelaifi has got problems of his own, the chairman of PSG, and he's, involved in a number of legal situations, which are a little bit difficult for him. You've got this Leonardo, who is really not liked at all at the club and by anybody. I'm terribly sorry, Leo. Then I can't go into specifics, but I've heard some very credible information about what was happening within the board itself, and which indicated that a few other people were not too happy there. A very important person, Sophie Jourdan, who is one of the key people at PSG, has actually just joined a new company, which is a film company, Wild Bunch. The Qataris have just bought it, and she's taken care of that, which would remove a very important person indeed from the hierarchy. See, I could carry on like this for a long time. This club is not in a good place. The team is, though. That's the paradox, and which might show that well, perhaps Pochettino is onto something. And it's true, he's got some decent players to play with. Now, if he were to go to Manchester United, it would be much, much easier. I mean, you talk about the superstars. Basically, you're talking, I think you were, you know, thinking of Cristiano Ronaldo and Paul Pogba.
Mm.
Well, I can't see that. First of all, I don't think that Ronaldo is somebody who poses the same problems as a Neymar, an Mbappe or a Messi at all. In terms, yes, he might be, the problems that he might pose are not the, you know, he's a fantastic trainer, he's an extraordinary professional. The problems he might pose is the fact that the team is a little bit, well, is unbalanced when he's in there, that he remains a sans pareil, non pareil goal scorer, but you're basically, without the ball, you're playing with 10 men or 9 outfield players. Paul Pogba, well, we don't really know. It's a mystery. And but he's not, when he's in the right mood, and maybe he would be in the right mood with Pochettino, he's an extraordinary asset. So he wouldn't be, he would find a squad that is probably too big and a motley crew, really, of players who don't quite fit in with each other. But I have no doubt he would be absolutely fine, as indeed will be whoever takes over for good from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I mean, this squad is just fantastic. It needs some seeing to, and probably, quite a lot of players being taken out of it, sold, moved on, and concentrating on some kind of structure for a team that has been lacking it for a while. But no, I mean, I really don't think it would be a problem at all for him.
Is there a scenario where things work out so well for Pochettino that he decides to stay at Paris Saint-Germain and that actually he isn't an option? How would that play out? What would need to happen?
I think there would need to be changes at the top of the hierarchy, or a different, completely different type of relationship with the hierarchy, and particularly with Leonardo, the sports director. As I said, there were rumors circulating over the last few days that Pochettino was willing to talk about extending his current contract, which expires in 2023, and go to 2024. So that is a possibility. What would be at the back of his mind, that PSG look set to lose Kylian Mbappe next summer. As I said, there are also doubts as to how long Lionel Messi would like to stay in Paris. Neymar is not getting any younger. I mean, it's possible there's going to have to be a rebuilding job to be done in 6 months' time. But it's not at all impossible. I mean, again, it depends on the type of relationship that can be promised to Pochettino, which he doesn't quite enjoy at the moment.
Okay, so it's not off the table that Manchester United put an interim manager in and don't get Pochettino in the summer as well. Like, because it's just assumed in the English papers this morning that, oh, it's Pochettino, because, well, he was here before, and as you said, he couldn't possibly turn down Manchester United, even though we've seen the Jurgen Klopp do it in the past.
It's extraordinary. I find it extraordinary. I have a look at what PSG has done both domestically and in Europe, and compare it to what Manchester United have done since the departure of Sir Alex Ferguson, and get back to me and see which one is the biggest team. Not the bigger club. Manchester United is a bigger club. Everybody know that. But the bigger team is Paris Saint-Germain. That's obvious. And it's quite extraordinary, this idea that nobody's career is complete without going to Manchester United, which is actually a crazy idea when you think that Manchester United had basically had Matt Busby, Alex Ferguson, and then other people since the end of World War II. So it's quite extraordinary, yes, is that the job is too big to be refused. And I mean, it could be, it is very tempting, obviously. I'm sure there are plenty of managers who would love to be managers of Manchester United. But this idea that somehow you can't say no to them is, I think, quite arrogant, really.
Yeah, absolutely. One last point about this. Is there an obvious non-Zidane manager of Paris Saint-Germain waiting in the wings if Manchester United were to pay the compensation and Paris Saint-Germain decide, okay, yeah, grand, who would that be?
To be honest, at the moment, there is nobody that comes straight to mind that PSG... I mean, to be honest, they've already used a few. And I can't see anybody currently who would fit immediately in the PSG role, which is also a problem.
That's a problem. Yeah. That is a big problem.
Yeah.
Paris Saint-Germain are going to say no, then obviously.
I know. I mean, maybe, you know, tell me. I mean, because basically all the big guys, I've got contracts at the moment. And there is another thing to be thought about as well, is that the disruptive impact of the World Cup happening in November, December 2022.
Mm.
Because usually World Cups are a moment where you do have, you know, quite a lot of action on the managerial merry-go-round, but that would be at club level, that is, as well as at national team level. Because, for example, if Deschamps were to leave, I mean, Zidane would go straight into the job with the French national team, for example, which would remove a very big player indeed from the field of possible candidates. So, and I know people keep talking about Zidane going to PSG, but honestly, again, everything is possible and they've got loads of means, and Zidane is not against the idea of making quite a lot of money, and perhaps he's starting to find it a little bit boring by the swimming pool since, what, now 5 months? The last 5 months? And he's somebody who wants, you know, action and so forth. He wants to be involved. But until now, I've always been told by people who are actually around PSG, and in some cases in PSG, that Zidane was a complete no-no.
Right.
And he wasn't interested. Things can change. You know, things can change. Yeah. But it would take a remarkable turn of events for Pochettino to go to Manchester. First of all, Manchester United to take the statement they made, to rip it apart. So, and tell Michael Carrick, thank you very much for taking us to the round of 16. Oh, and by the way, Mr. Valverde, Mr. Rangnick, and so forth, weren't interested in you anymore. And then hire a permanent manager mid-season or almost mid-season, and Pochettino accepting to go, and PSG accepting the compensation, and being left without a manager when they have just qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League and are running away with the title. And Zidane saying, well, okay, I'm coming out of retirement to take over a club I didn't want to take care of.
It's fantasy. It is fantasy football.
I mean, you know, when you look at it from a distance, and again in football, you know, if we think of what happened this summer with the Ronaldo Messi situation, I think very few of us would have said this could happen. But it did. But even if it was very unexpected, it's not quite as far-fetched as the kind of things that people are talking about right now.
Okay. I do want to talk to you, Philippe, before we go, about this breaking story this morning where two Norwegian television journalists have been arrested in Qatar. It feels a little bit like the world is beginning to wake up and put proper focus on the fact that the World Cup is in Qatar, and there are many stories that need to be covered in depth every time we speak about the World Cup in Qatar. In a weird way, stuff like this is going to help, because you can't ignore the arrest of television journalists who are just reporting on a story in Qatar.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Two journalists from the Norwegian network, NRK. And at the same time, obviously, there's also the situation of one of the former comms people from the Supreme Committee, from the Qatari Supreme Committee, Abdullah Ibn Hais, who was arrested and was charged with attempted bribery and could risk 5 years in prison, is currently on a hunger strike. And you add to that the report that was published by Amnesty International just a few days ago, which is a damning report really about the rights of migrant workers, particularly in Qatar. You add to that the fact that you now have as well documentaries being released. I mean, there is one on Discovery, of the Discovery Channel. I know there are two others which are going to be released very soon, which are all about the awarding of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar by FIFA, and which obviously deal with all the allegations of bribery, corruption and so forth, which have been in the public domain for a while. And this, as we are just 1 year away. And in a way, you know, in Qatar, there were quite a few people who were not too happy with the country bidding for the World Cup, because they said it will attract too much attention on us. And in fact, what is happening is, yes, there is an awful lot of focus. Some of it is on what is going to happen on the pitch. Like recently, Mr. Gianni Infantino, the chairman of FIFA, was in Doha to see what had been done with the stadiums and so forth, where he was joined by Mr. Bolsonaro, strong man of Brazil, and where there were a few photo ops, and that was all positive story and so forth. But the negative stuff is only the I mean, is really bad. It's when I mean really bad, it's bad in itself, and it's also bad for the organizers, because the focus, you have to say as well, and I should add that Norway was really that close, very, very, very close, from boycotting the World Cup. There was a large movement, grassroots movement, and the Norway Federation is actually run as a democracy up to a point. And the majority of people wanted to bail out, and they said, even if you qualify, don't want to go. And it was only in June, 20th of June, I think, that the Norwegian Federation twisted a few arms, actually quite a lot of arms, and managed to get that motion off the table. No doubt it will come back after what happened. Absolutely no doubt about that. Then you've got as well, the Danish players as well are starting to be very vocal about that. Then you heard what Conor Cody had to say about it as well, which means that the England national team might also start to make comments about the situation in the country, in the host country. Now the qualifiers are over, people are going to talk even more about the situation there. So it is, these are going to be some, I think, very interesting months ahead to the start of the World Cup in November 2022. And I'm afraid at the moment things aren't looking too good for the image of Qatar, who precisely got the World Cup, wanted the World Cup to build their reputation, to build their find themselves a bigger place on the world stage and so forth. Well, it is a bigger place on the world stage, but not necessarily for the good reasons.
How do you see that playing out over the next little while, Philippe? And maybe the easiest way to ask this question is through your own profession. I mean, it's obviously something that I'm sure you've been considering about how you cover this thing next year.
Yeah.
Where is that thought process at the moment between, I guess, yourself and your colleagues?
I think as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I myself write for a Norwegian publication which has been very vocal on this question called Josimar, and I will carry on reporting on the situation there, and I'm quite involved in that as well. I mean, I was one of the people who started the ball rolling when, you know, released the Qatargate dossier for France Football all those years ago, and I've carried on working on that. So I see very much my role as a journalist to report on what is happening in the country there in the wider sense. And I don't think it's possible to do anything other than that. And it's a situation that I think all of our colleagues are going to be in. I think the situation is going to be very different between the rights holders and the non-rights holders. That's the way I would put it. If you have bought the rights to the World Cup for a lot of money, be you a radio or especially a television station or a platform, streaming platform, you're not going to want to talk, to diss, or to disrespect or to say bad things about a country which is hosting a tournament that you've just spent a fortune to broadcast. This is not a problem that you will have if you report for the Irish Times or the Daily Telegraph or France Football, or, you know, any of those publications. So, yes, there will be an awful lot. There will be even more coverage. And I think both are going to run in parallel, which is something that we've never seen before, even though we could and should perhaps have seen before. I think we could have seen that for Russia 2018. We didn't see it. It's very different this time. Perhaps people are less wary of confronting what is happening in Qatar than they were of confronting what's happening in the land of Vladimir Putin. We're going to have the situation with China as well in the Olympic Games.
Yeah.
So it's, I think, honestly, it's perhaps what defines the job of a sports journalist these days. We have to cover these issues as much as anything that is happening on the field or in the dressing room or in the boardrooms. You know, the same thing goes for our colleagues who cover Formula One. When they saw Lewis Hamilton sport a rainbow-coloured helmet at the qualifiers for the Qatar Grand Prix, which was quite a gesture. You know, it's something as well that, for example, we're discussing as well for the colleagues of ours who are going. I'm not going personally to Qatar for the World Cup, to especially if they are members of LGBTQ plus communities, to make sure that they're safe and how they can report on issues related to their communities there. You see, there it's there's going to be a big conversation, I think.
I think
it's not going to be an easy one.
No,
and that's for sure.
We'll have to keep having it because,
yes,
in a weird way, the Qatari authorities are making it much easier to have those conversations by arresting journalists and making everybody aware exactly of what's happening. And so it becomes this kind of inevitability that the
absolutely.
Story,
yeah. And you know what? One of the biggest fears of people who work in the field of human rights is when it comes to Qatar is the fact that once the World Cup has been played, the focus will go elsewhere. And if we don't get things changed quickly, and getting things changed quickly, by the way, only means asking the Qataris to put into practice all the beautiful words they've been using since 2009.
Yeah.
That's because they've kept talking about abolishing this and abolishing that and allowing this and allowing that. And you look at the reality, and the reality, as is put in the Amnesty International report, which again is online, was published just a few days ago. The reality doesn't match the great words, the fine words of the Supreme Committee.
It very rarely does when it comes to stuff like this. Philippe,
yes.
Brilliantly put. Thanks a million for joining us this morning. Cheers.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
It's Philippe Beauclair giving us two sides to the big stories in world football at the moment. That was, just to recap, two Norwegian TV journalists have been arrested in Qatar. They were released 36 hours later, but without their equipment. Halvor Eklund and Lachman Gorbani were arrested in Qatar after reporting on the preparations for the World Cup, and now they're on their way home to Norway. It is 8:57 this morning. The Koi Gig podcast with Kathleen McNamee and Karen Duggan on OTB Sports is brought to you in association with Cadbury FC, official snack partner to the women's national team. This week we were joined by Tom Elms, the new assistant coach of the Irish women's national team. Have a look.
We had Amber Barrett on the show last week, and she was talking about how glad she was that, you know, she finished her college education before she went off and like moved abroad to play. Do you think that like providing those pathways for players is important?
Yeah, I can't stress how important it is. I think young players have an education to fall back on. You know, you talk in general of the percentage of players that actually make it to that top level. You know, you mentioned the boys' game, but not only that, now the women's game is growing at a very fast rate. So more and more players have been exposed to opportunities over in the UK. And, you know, and the dropouts, just eventually it's going to be just as significant in the female game. Only females that might drop out probably haven't earned the money that their male counterparts may have done. So it can make it very difficult for them. So, you know, personally, I think we can support our young players with an education, first and foremost. It's massively important. And look, some choose to do that in the US. There's great experiences to be had over there. If that's what they want to do and travel, you can do that. But I think you're seeing a lot of courses now, you know, offering sports scholarships, opportunities for players to stay and play in this country. We've seen a number of institutions aligning themselves with National League clubs. Again, you know, that kind of joint-up approach, and teams then are getting the exposure to the players. They're getting immediately regularly training and in a good environment. And then education-wise, we're making sure our players are getting that on the side. And, you know, if you can do the two and combine the two at the same time, I think it'd be better for you. You know, it shouldn't always be in a rush to jump into professional football. But if it's there, it's a tough decision at the time, but you know, I think it's really, really important. Like you said, Amber mentioned it. She's in professional football now. She's loving it. There's other players that are in similar positions, and they've all gone and got their degrees. Their education is behind them. And look, when that time comes that either they've reached the end of their playing career, or if their playing career is cut short in any fashion, that they have that to fall back on. I think that's really important.
Yeah, you can get the Koi Gig podcast on all our podcast platforms. The best place to get it, of course, is the OTB Sports app. There is breaking French news this morning. French courts have convicted Karim Benzema of complicity in attempted blackmail. We'll get more details on this, but that's Reuters this morning reporting that Karim Benzema might be facing a difficult period over the next while, with the potential for some jail time coming his way after being convicted of attempted blackmail. So that story finally rumbling towards its conclusion. No doubt there'll be an appeal.
Just Get French Football News have just tweeted in the last minute saying Karim Benzema handed 1 year suspended prison sentence and a €75,000 fine after being found guilty of complicity in the act of blackmail.
He's going to find that as a win. Any time that you don't go to prison for being convicted of blackmail, you'd have to say is a win. It's bang on 9 o'clock this morning. If you've just joined us, you're very welcome along to OTBAM. It's the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. We're here with you every morning from 7:30 through until 10. You can get it to play on your smart speaker. Just tell your Alexa or your Siri or your Google Home to play OTB Sports Radio, and away you go. Now, let's move on and talk to Conor McManus about Gaelic football. Conor joins us this morning with thanks to Imagine Broadband. Imagine Broadband is continuing to expand its high-speed network in rural areas that are currently unserviced by fibre networks. Visit imagine.ie today to check availability in your area. Conor, good morning. How are you getting on?
Sure, how are you? How's things?
Yeah, pretty good. This is a very straightforward question. When a team like Tyrone, who you are very close to and play year in, year out, go on winning the All-Ireland, how sickened are you by that?
Next question, Joe.
It must be a little bit kind of like, because we hear this hoary old cliche, the Ulster counties all support each other when they come down to Croke Park, but that can't be true, because they're your nearest rivals and nearest neighbours, and you're like always up against them in big games, and you beat them in Ulster quite a lot, but then they go and make the breakthrough. It's like, I'm delighted for them. Couldn't happen to a nicer bunch.
Yeah, you paint a very good picture there. It's difficult whenever you see one of your Ravens going on and doing ultimately what you want to go and do, you know. And I suppose we've been knocking on the door against Tyrone and that this last number of years. Beat them some days, didn't beat them other days. Obviously this year in Ulster final we didn't beat them. They go on ahead and beat Kerry and beat Mayo in an All-Ireland final, you know, and you'd have to say deservedly so, and hats off to them. They went and they got it done. But I suppose from our point of view, it doesn't make it any easier sitting looking on. But on the flip side of that, it probably gives you a wee bit more encouragement than maybe the likes of Tyrone or some of those teams over the last number of years have been going to them semi-finals and finals ourselves and falling short against the Dublins and of this world. So it gives you a wee bit of encouragement also that, you know, when you see the likes of Tyrone going on ahead and closing the deal out, you know, why not some of the rest of us.
What made this Tyrone team this year so capable of closing those games out, as you mentioned there?
Well, I'd say probably like they got over the line against ourselves in a tight game at Croke Park in the Ulster final, and they probably gathered a wee bit of momentum from that. They carried into the Kerry game. They played a certain style of football which I don't think Kerry were ready for on the day. And they totally outworked them and outfought them more so than anything else. And I suppose, look at when you get a big win in Croke Park like that, and on the back of winning an Ulster title in Croke Park, it gives you a lot of confidence. And you can see that in Tyrone going into the All-Ireland final, that they were just going out and playing with total confidence and no real regard for who they were playing, you know, be it Kerry, Mayo, or whoever else was going to be coming their way. They were just playing their own game and you know, hats off to them.
That no real regard for who you're playing. Did you feel that there was a bit of a shift this year and that there can be a shift over the next little while now that Mayo have actually beaten Dublin, that Dublin have been beaten essentially? Like, was that a as big a psychological barrier as much as anything else, the fact that it did seem that they were invincible at times?
Yeah, well, everybody knows this last 6 years what Dublin have done and how good they've been in tight games. They've always found a way to get over the line, and ultimately this year they came up short. But you know, when you're a team on the bounce for a seventh year on a row, you know, they had already won six, it's very, very hard to keep that going, and it's incredible that they've done what they've done. So it was going to always come to an end, and it was always going to come down. A day was always going to come for Dublin when a team just wanted it that wee bit more, and you could see that in Mayo this year. You know, I do expect Dublin to be back in the reckoning now next year, and they'll dust themselves off and they'll go again. But definitely the thing is more even now than it was for a long number of years, you know.
That's the other side, isn't it? Like the annoyance that somebody else got it done instead of you, that once that passes, then it's like, hang on a second, at the start of the year, right, when Owen's doing his famous power rankings at the start of the year, there's going to be a big debate about who goes where and just how close all those teams are to each other.
Yeah, well, look, it probably is closer than it has been. And at the start of every year, it's always said it's going to be a competitive championship and it's really tight and it's difficult. But, you know, it definitely is. You know, it definitely is really tight. And even if you take Ulster on its own, you know, there's any one of five, six, seven teams who would fancy themselves to win an Ulster title there, you know. So it's really, really competitive. And then obviously you have Kerry under new management this year. Mayo will be coming back. Galway would fancy themselves coming back into the reckoning again, and obviously Dublin as well. So it's a really tough championship, and we're going to be competitive, and we'll also get a better look at it this year now because we have a full round of National League fixtures as well. So we'll have a better idea where people are sitting in by the end of that.
Yeah, and there's going to be a back door at least, so that you're not getting straight knockout in the championship.
And the McKenna Cup's then as well. So
everybody was missing the McKenna Cup, obviously.
Yeah.
You're delighted. Training starts on the 8th of December officially. The rest of the country is taking the day off to go to Dublin, and you guys are all getting back to training.
Yeah, we'll be back.
It's great news, isn't it?
Yeah. And I love it. It's a condensed season. So we'll then. It does. In fairness, the time scale around it is tighter, so you can see that you're not looking at, you know, it's 8, 9, 10 months now. And saying that, you'd gladly do that if it was taking you to an All Ireland semi final or final. But reality is, every player in the country now knows that it's a six month buy in from here on in. Like, so it does make that commitment or that buy in a wee bit easier, you know.
The great thing is that there is McKenna Cup and that there's not a proposal B, because, I mean, everybody was doing the work for Monaghan over the last few months, Conor. Everybody was fighting against the idea of this Team 6 from Division 1 not being included in the knockout stages of the All-Ireland Championship. Did that warm the heart a little bit to hear the people from the Ulster Council and the Leinster Council coming out and fighting your cause?
I'm not sure they were fighting for us now. I'm not sure they were fighting solely for us now. But I did feel as if it wasn't a really the idea is good, you know, and there were a lot of pluses to it, but it has highlighted the need for change anyway. That's one thing we all know, but as we all know as well, in the GAA it takes time to get change in, so God knows when this will happen
indeed. I'm not retiring you yet, but like it could be another 10 years away, and I, you know, maybe you will still be kicking 9 points a game in 10 years.
No. I can assure you of that.
I did want to ask you, right, you've had a front row seat for the complete evolution of how the game has changed over the last decade or so, over the last 15 years. Right? Your inter-county career coincides with a period where it was ultra-defensive and games could have finished 7-8-7 or 9-6, and we would have thought, well, that's kind of how it goes. To now, it's like 119-117, and they're classics, even among traditional defensive powerhouses. What happened? Why do you think the change has happened?
I think there's so much more work going into teams now. Like from when I started training with Monaghan back this time of the year in 2006. In preparation for the 2007 season, and the difference in the levels of attention to detail, the difference in the levels of attention to training, to analysis, to how you can improve, to how you can get better, and picking your way around defensive screens and organising teams in terms of offensively, defensively, your own kickouts, opposition kickouts. The level of work and the level of detail that's gone into preparing inter-county teams now is just unbelievable, like, compared to where it was when I came in. And when I came in, Monaghan were lifted to a level that they had never been at before. But comparing to where they're at now to then, it's just a total different game altogether, you know. So you had in the mid-teens, you know, where I suppose Jim McGuinness came in and ultimately changed Gaelic football. you had that period of defensive football and you had then games where they were finishing 10-8 or 11-9 or whatever it may be, then obviously Dublin found a way around that. And in order to compete then, you had to beat Dublin. And in order to beat Dublin, you had to go to Croke Park and score 116, 17, 18, 19. All the while, defensive screens and sweepers remained in place. So it has become just a think tank, basically, in how you can get around these things and how you can still knock up them 117, 118 score lines whilst trying to keep it tight at the back. I know that sounds contradictory, but that's the reality where it's at. Like, you look at Dublin over the last number of years, they still had at times 14 men behind the ball, 15 men behind the ball. And in order to beat that, you had to be fit to post 117, 118. So the level of work and the amount of attention to detail and the amount of analysis and you know, video room and work that's going on in inter-county teams and events is phenomenal, you know.
Is it enjoyable?
It is enjoyable, and I suppose that's a question that gets posted around a lot, you know, is are players enjoying it? And, you know, there probably is more of a dropout amongst inter-county players now than maybe there ever has been, or maybe it's just been highlighted more, I'm not too sure. But if you go to dressing rooms and ask guys are they enjoying it, like, I don't think you're going to get too many men saying, no, I'm here just because I feel as if I have to be here. No, I don't think that's the answer. At the end of the day, like, whenever I look back and whenever the day does come that I have to hang up my boots, I look back as my 15, 16, 17 years with Bond as the best years of my life, you know. So it certainly isn't a grind, that's for sure.
And is it more enjoyable now, in a way? Like, the fact that you're actually trying to score 119 as opposed to trying to win games with 10, 11, 12 points?
Yeah, well, it probably is. It's the game is a wee bit more free-flowing, and I suppose from a spectator's point of view, it's maybe a wee bit better. But then games back then, and you know, whilst it's got a lot of negative press at the time, they were quite interesting as well, and trying, you know, watching teams trying to break down defences and figure things out. And I know being involved in some of them games ourselves with Monaghan, you know, the level of detail and work that you had to go just to try and work your way around and navigate your way around at blanket defence was, and actually coming out on the right side of it, there was a certain enjoyment in that as well, you know.
Yeah, well, it feels like we've kind of reached that evolution. It's where defences were on top for a while and then the best thinkers went away and came up with plans to break them down. And, you know, there could very well be a defensive cycle around the corner in a couple of years' time. Who knows?
It will come again. Somebody will come up with a plan that's going to be very hard to beat for a year or two. And as you say, everybody else has to go back to the tank again and rethink things. So it will continue to evolve. And as you say, we could be back in a couple of years' time looking at defensive screens again.
Well, hopefully they don't change the rules and tamper with things just to try and fix things that aren't actually broken. Conor, great stuff. You obviously don't have any intention to announce your retirement sooner rather than later. You're going to see how the off-season and next season goes. Or are you already committed to next season for sure?
Yeah. No. We go again. We'll look after a couple of injuries and a couple of knocks that unfortunately come your way at this age more than you would like. But we'll get the body right and we'll go again in 2022.
Am I right in saying did you move back to Monaghan as a result of the pandemic, or was that before the pandemic?
No, that was before. That was before. Yeah, I could see the pandemic coming, so I just.
and do you feel like that's kind of maybe not elongated the career a little bit, but giving you a bit more freshness? I know it's obviously not maybe just the same level of a drive that some of the Mayo lads would have had to do in previous years, but getting up and down the road, like.
Yeah, when I was in Dublin there for whatever it was, 4 years or whatever it was, there was, you know, it was taxing, you know. And like, again, we were not at the same level as Mayo from the point of view that we weren't looking at a 3 or 3.5 hour journey. We were an hour and a half, 2 hours, depending on traffic and things like that, you know. So we were on the borderline whereby it wasn't feasible for us to be training in Dublin and the boys down the road training at home, two separate groups. So we were always training together. So you did have that to contend with, but yeah, it has had, you know, been local and just the small things in terms of getting into your car after training and you're back home in 15, 20 minutes, you know, or less. So things like that make a big difference, you know, in terms of recovery and sleep and nutrition and all them things that you're trying to tick off when you're playing into county football, you know.
It might be no harm to have a little niggle in the back or in a hamstring that nobody can quite pinpoint for December and early January, so that you can re-emerge fresh in February, March.
I'm on top of that here. I've already looked after that here. In the last league game, I managed to break a bone or two in my hand, so that'll be me on the shelf for a couple of weeks anyway.
Right. Were you punching the ball? Is that what happened?
Actually, no. It was very accidental. Now, in fairness, but yeah. So I'll be on the sidelines for a wee while just. Well, listen,
we wish you the best of the recovery. Great to have you with us, Conor. Thanks a million. Cheers.
All right, guys. Thanks.
It's Conor McManus there, one of the legends of Gaelic football, talking to us with thanks to Imagine Broadband. Imagine Broadband is continuing to expand its high-speed network in rural areas that are currently unserviced by fibre networks. Visit imagine.ie today to check availability in your area. What were you going to say?
Well, that's it now. If McManus is out, I'm not watching the McKenna Cup.
I think there's still going to be big crowds.
Of course.
If the crowds are allowed to go to the McKenna Cup games, it'll be like, no one's going to go to matches in January. And then like 9,000 go to a McKenna Cup game because there's been no inter-county action in such a long time.
Yeah.
It's the most obvious thing of all time.
What was the figure in the papers last week that there was a McKenna Cup game in 2006?
600,000 were at it.
2006, yeah. Our maths were on that year. I think it was 15
minutes past nine. Here's what's coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. OTB Gold at 1 o'clock is an Irish football special with Given, Quinn, McAteer and Kilbane. It's good crack. The Koi Gig Pod is live from 3, a retro panel, keeping a level head at 4 o'clock. OTB Gold is Colm, Gooch, Cooper. Those retro panels, I just have the keeping a level head. I've no idea who's on it. So it'll be a little Easter egg for you, a magical mystery tour about who the guests might be. But I know they're talking about keeping a level head. That's on today at 4 o'clock. Get on to OTB Sports Radio. It'll be a companion all day for you on the OTB Sports app. We're bringing you our Black Friday gift guide with Jess Kelly next.
OTB AM.
Right, News Talk's tech correspondent Jess Kelly is with us. Jess, good morning to you. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
When is Black Friday?
This Friday, the 26th.
Okay, so we're only 2 days away. Right.
Yeah, but it starts like 2 weeks ago. This is the annoying thing and it's the great thing. So what some shops do is they will start it from pretty much the start of November and drag it out. And then other retailers either will start pushing out private mailing list deals from Monday of this week that will expire on Monday of next week, because Monday of next week is Cyber Monday. So we now have two ridiculous tech consumer heavy sale days.
And if you are going to buy stuff, you should probably have been able to get the right price on it by now, or is there still some actual proper bargains to be had either on Friday or Monday?
There will be extra flash sales on Friday and Monday. So what I would say to people is find what you're looking for now and shop around and see what the deals are. Like certain big retailers like Amazon, I know, will go heavy on Friday. They will push these, I think it's like 15-minute deals. They're called lightning deals. So for smaller things, if you need a new cable for your phone or stuff like that, you may get like them for dirt cheap on Friday or Monday. But the next issue then is stock, because a lot of websites are showing sales. They're showing really good prices, but then they can't get the stock because of the chip shortage. So I think if you find a deal and if it's cheaper than you were expecting and it's not cheaper somewhere else, go for it. That would be my advice.
Okay. One last thing about, you mentioned Amazon there. Is everybody shopping on Amazon.de or .es now rather than shopping on .co.uk because of the impact of Brexit?
I'm still going .co.uk. You know, I'm not using it as much as I was previously. I know that a lot of people are going .de. I'm not 100% sure why. Like, I think if you read the terms and conditions of Amazon, if you're buying something for under €150, you will see the price, including VAT, including all the bits and pieces that you need to know on the finished page. So when you check out, if it's over €150, that's where you need to pay a little bit more attention, but just make sure that you read the terms and conditions. The big issue that we're going to face, regardless of whether you're ordering .co.uk, .de or wherever it is getting into the country. The postal service, the delivery companies, all of those companies will struggle over the coming weeks. Personally speaking, as I said, I've been using .co.uk and haven't been stung at all by it.
Okay. One of the big things that you wanted to talk to us about was the this is an amazing bargain, buy it now. I'm a sucker for this. In our local shop, they'll put like, this is only $3.99. I'm like, that's an amazing price. Mm. Or is it? Was it normally like $2.99? And now that you've got like that flashy thing in front of me, I'm like, they must have this bargain. And it turns out that's the same with like your big ticket TVs that, this is an amazing price. It's only $8.99. You're like, it was $7.99 last week.
So there's absolutely mountains of that going on. And I love shopping. I love buying, particularly tech. I think it's my favorite thing to do. But, you know, the shops are pretty smart about it. Remember that these are businesses. There are some old stock that will go for quite cheap, but a lot of the websites now will show the dates that a price was set. So, for example, if you go on to any of the big Irish retailers this morning, if you find a product that you want, you will see that it has been at that current price for X to Y. Now, some skeptics out there will say that they will raise the price for October and then drop it in time for Black Friday. That could happen, but, you know, I think you need to be wise about it. The other thing I would say, and I've spent a lot of time over the last few weeks looking at the best deals and so on, some retailers are saying that they have the best deal, but then you go to the next retailer and then you find the same thing, the exact same product, same color, everything for 30 quid cheaper. So don't get suckered in by those flashy signs, the black tags, the red tags, whatever. Make sure you shop around. And by shopping around, I do literally mean going to three or four different retailers or three or four different websites, because you will, I promise you, you will notice a disparity. And it's not the case that one shop is always cheaper than another. That's not how it works. So it does require legwork, but you can get some good deals.
Okay. Give us some good deals that are out there at the moment then, Jess. What are you looking at?
Okay, so we always, at this time of year on OTBAM, we talk about a wearable. I'm wearing an Apple Watch at the moment, but I think my favorite wearable of the last 12 months is the Huawei Watch Fit New. So Huawei have taken a bit of a battering in terms of their phones because they had that fallout with Google, but their accessories are excellent. This looks the nicest, I think, of all of the wearables. It's normally €99 and it's now €79. And just to flag, because it's made by Huawei, that doesn't mean it just works with Huawei phones. You can get it to work with any device, whether it is Apple or Android. So that is £79 now.
Okay, so do all the wearables do fairly much the same thing at this point?
Pretty much. You know, you do get some extra bells and whistles on the more expensive ones. I remember last year we were talking about the Fitbit Sense. That is the Fitbit that's around £350. And it does have medical grade information. So it is pretty spectacular. But for most people, what they want is a step counter, exercise tracker, sleep tracker, and then to be able to get some of your messages and stuff like that. And for the most part, they will all do that. But as I said, having tested about 50 of them in the last 12 months, this one is definitely my favourite.
Okay. What have you got? What's yours?
I'm Garmin. I'm a Garmin for life guy. Until I see the price of this is only $79.99 this week, and then I might actually be a Huawei for life guy. Garmin is good.
I thought you were an Apple fanboy, though, and I thought you like buy anything with an Apple on it.
I mean, people are looking on my spot that for my laptop. I've gone iPhone this year. I've got an iPad. I've got an Apple TV. Do I go full Apple?
The Apple TV can be pre-installed now on all TVs.
Yeah, but I mean, we got one for free with Air broadband, so
okay.
That's why I have it. The iPad came for free with a Sunday Times subscription, so I got I just take the free shit.
I moved to iPhone this year. I've got to say, I think Android's still better.
It's completely insignificant, the difference, especially the price you're paying for.
Well, the battery is better on the iPhone for sure.
No, it's not.
Oh, definitely.
Android, confirm this for me, Jess. Android better than iPhone, obviously.
I still prefer Android to iPhone. Now, I'm still using an iPhone 13 myself, but I do prefer Android. I'm sure you can customize it. I think the battery on a lot of them is actually better than iPhone, but the camera on the iPhone is one of the best out there for sure.
That's pretty class, to be fair.
Okay, TVs, mm-hmm. Right. The best thing I did during lockdown was buy the biggest TV I could find. For the first 3 or 4 months, you're kind of sitting there and the head's blown off you. But now it's like it's just a normal part of life. And buy the biggest TV because it's the thing you spend the most time with. Not your family, it's your TV. As we all know, as Homer Simpson says, it's the most important thing in your life. Get whatever you can.
Yeah.
What recommendation have you got for us?
Yeah, I completely echo everything you've just said there. And the other thing I would say to add to that is, if you think you only have space for a 50-inch TV, go 55, go bigger, because the big borders around the TV don't exist anymore. It's like a super thin bezel. So get your measuring tape out, measure corner to corner, and then go a little bit bigger. That would be my bad advice. But the recommendation for today is the Samsung Q60A. It's a 4K Ultra HD HDR QLED TV. All that means is it looks class. The QLED screens are stunning, 55-inch, so it is nice and big, 4K content looks great on it. The one thing I would say if you are buying a 4K TV is that some streaming services, like Netflix, for example, will make you pay for the higher tier of subscription to get 4K content. So just don't be disheartened if you get your 4K TV and everything kind of looks the same.
Yeah.
You may have to pay extra for that. That's how they get you. But this TV, it was $1,199 and it's now $739. I have a Samsung TV here in my living room and I absolutely love it. I think the interface is the easiest and most intuitive of all the TVs. So I think that is a pretty good price for that.
Yeah, and in fairness to the TVs, because you recommended against getting you preferred the Samsung to the LG. LG have improved. They do mm-hmm. constantly update. So if you do get stuck with one that isn't currently great, don't worry. They are making them better.
Samsung gave me a lend of a massive TV for the last World Cup, and I'm still squinting now that I look at my current TV. It's like, what is this, a football match for ants? Or, like, whenever I turn it on, it's absolutely...
Owen Issues, come and get me, please, a Samsung TV.
Samsung, I'm available once again for Qatar 2022.
Or so you're just begging for an Apple Watch there a second ago. You need to pick a side, though, and pick a side, and then the free stuff will come flowing.
I like balance, and I'm a floating voter when it comes to Samsung versus Apple. So I will happily step in both camps.
He's curious, our own. Google Nest Audio is next.
Yeah, so this is the new name for Google Home, the Google Smart Assistant. I am a Google Home person. So I have my Google Nest Audio, which is the big speaker. At the moment, you can get them for £80. They're usually £100, so that is a good deal. The reason I go with Google is because everything else in my house is Google. We have the Google Chromecast in the TV. We have the Philips Hue lights. So everything is connected, and it means then that I can give orders to my Google Nest Audio, and it will do it. But also the sound quality is class. So if you just want it as a speaker and, you know, to check the time or ask if it's raining outside so you don't have to look out the window, that is completely fine. But again, it's a very, very impressive device. And that could be like the nucleus of your smart home. So if you know somebody who's interested in building a smart home, the Google Nest Audio is a really good starting point.
Okay, and the audio sounds good?
It's really good, yeah. Like, now, it's not quite as good as the Apple HomePod. Owen will be delighted to hear. I have the Apple HomePod there. It's a little white thing. So it's very, very small. It's slightly bigger than a tennis ball. And the sound quality from the Apple HomePod Mini is incredible. But, like, we're kind of splitting hairs over nothing here. Do you know what I mean? The sound quality from the Nest is still excellent.
Okay, all right. The next is the Kindle, right? And there are multiple Kindles. I was on a flight recently and was using the Kindle on my phone. I was like, actually, I want a Kindle now. I had one originally, it broke, and I never got another one, and now I want one again. It's kind of got to that point where I'm going to do some business with Jeff Bezos. Is there some way of getting a Kindle without doing business with Jeff Bezos? I don't know.
No, No. You could buy another brand that isn't as good.
That's the thing. They aren't as good, are they?
No, and I've tried loads of them. Again, there's a Kobo brand, I think it's called. I had it. It was fine. Like, it did the job, but I don't mind using an Amazon product when it is as useful to me as the Kindle is. So I have all three Kindles. I have the basic one, I have the Paperwhite one, and then I have the Oasis, which is the Notions one. And that's the bigger screen, and it has buttons on the side. Unless you're a big reader, you probably don't need it. I go for the Paperwhite. The Paperwhite is the one in the middle that has the slightly bigger screen. So I think it's a 6.7 inch screen. So the text kind of, it just feels more like a book in my opinion. But there are good deals on the basic model at the moment. So they're normally $79.99 and it's down to $59.99. So if you're not sure if you're going to use it, if you like the idea of it, but you're not sure that you're going to commit to it, I would go with the basic one, and then you can, of course, upgrade as time goes by. But what I would say is that you do need to engage them with the Kindle ebook store thing to get your books. But it does also pair up with the Audible app, which I use. So sometimes you can opt to download the audiobook and the physical book as well when you're making a purchase, which is quite nice.
Yeah, and you can send PDFs to it as well. So they are useful good bits of kit. So £60 for the basic one is a good price at the moment, and they are available. The earbuds, right? You know, you've had some incidents with earbuds in the past. You've got.
Why do you bring this up every year? Like, it's 3 years ago now. Thanks. So mean.
The whole of the Stephen's Green Shopping Centre was closed so that Jess could recover her earbuds, which she had already bought a replacement for. Anyway, we don't need to go back into it. No need to bring it up, as you say, Jess. But there are good ones at the moment, and there's good offers on them.
Yeah, so it's the latest iteration of the ones that I lost and caused havoc over. They are brilliant. They are the Samsung Galaxy Buds 2. So the Buds range have been around for quite a while. We've spoken about all the previous iterations over the years. The key difference with these ones, which is the newest ones, is that they're just more comfortable. So I'm wearing the Pro version at the moment. And while they're grand, I'm constantly afraid that they're going to fall out of my ear. That hasn't happened at all with the Buds 2. They are just incredibly comfortable. The battery life is better. The sound quality is amazing, not just for listening to music, but also if you're working from home, which I am at the moment, to be able to take calls and video calls and stuff like that through them. It's just a bit of a game changer. They're usually quite expensive. They're usually around between 179 and 159, depending on where you go. But they're available at the moment for £120.
Okay, so that is a proper reduction as well. And so long as you don't lose them, they are a really good bit of kit.
Didn't you hear the news? Wired headphones are back in.
Oh yeah, I mean,
they're the new fashion statement. So
like vinyl,
just like vinyl. And if you're on the move and you can't listen to your vinyl or can't bring it with you, then you can put in a good old pair of wired headphones, and you're trendy again.
You're putting them into your you can't put them into your iPhone.
No, I have the jack.
Yeah. Oh God!
An extra little bit of kit that you had to buy, as well as the
best
earphones.
Purchase I've ever made. Buy for your family this year.
Okay,
folks.
And so why are you hot for your wired earphones?
I wear wired earphones every so often. I see People magazine said trendy people wear wired earphones every so often. So that's just the connection. That's
okay,
all I'm saying.
Okay. And as a regular jogger, and you know, I know you like to. You're physically active. You
so
garden.
Active.
Your garden is
so active.
Is very manicured.
Yeah.
You can do that with your wires. You can't.
You can.
Okay, you can't. The next one is a Philips air dryer. Air fryer.
Yeah, you were close, but not quite. So this is a device that is probably the most used device in my home. So I can't cook, I can't drive, I'm pretty crap at being an adult, but I can throw stuff in the air fryer. And the idea is that there are two dials on it, one for the temperature, one for the time. So you can do anything from making a fry up to a full chicken dinner. You just throw it in, and because it uses the natural oils of the food, you don't need to cook with oil. So it's healthy and it's easy. And it is on sale at the moment for €117. It's normally €180. So again, that is a good bargain.
Where's that? Everywhere.
Where?
Yeah.
As in what shop?
Yeah.
I was like, in my house? Do you want a tour of my house? It's in the kitchen, Jer. It's a kitchen device. No, you can get it for €117 in Harvey Norman right now.
Okay. Because we're going to be moving house soon to a place with no proper kitchen, and I'm going to have to get a lot of these type of things.
You don't have an air fryer?
I don't have an air fryer.
Yeah, it's a life changer.
Oh, is it?
Genuine life changer.
Oh, you're okay. All the millennials are
everything
like...
You just toss it in there. Toss everything in there. And it just cooks healthily. Like, I mean, anything from your freezer, just take it out of the box and fire it into the air fryer.
That's healthy.
That's gourmand shit you're talking there.
Absolutely.
Anything from your freezer. Okay.
Anything you want.
Okay. Well, give me examples.
Waffles, chicken dippers. You can do rashers in an air fryer.
Okay. All very healthy. Chicken dippers may now contain actual chicken.
Vegan chicken dippers, actually, as good as the original.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
That's also a life hack for anybody out there.
Okay. So an air fryer, it should be on everybody's Black Friday, Cyber Monday list. And the Samsung Watch 4, we're going to talk about this as well, are we?
Yeah, just briefly, because this is another good wearable. So if you aren't into the Huawei watch, if you want something that is a step up and looks more like a normal watch, the Samsung Watch 4 is excellent. It's probably the closest Android watch to an Apple watch. It's normally $279, but the Black Friday price is $219. What I would say is that it's probably made for a bigger wrist. When I had it for review, I kind of felt like it was taking up the whole of my wrist, which I didn't like. So just keep that in mind if you have a smaller wrist.
Okay, so for big people, $219 for the Samsung Watch 4. That's a good reduction. That's the level of reduction that you can get if you shop around for most stuff over the next couple of, over this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Jess, good stuff. Anything else you want to tell us?
No, that's kind of it. I've nothing else.
Plug your show at the weekend.
Oh, yeah, I've got a show. It's called Tech Talk, and you should listen to it now. It's on, available as a podcast on Fridays at noon or Saturday at 5 p.m. And I have a YouTube show called Tech Bites. If you head over to the News Talk YouTube channel, you can find 5 episodes there talking through some of the best devices of the year.
Excellent. Jess, good stuff. Great to have you with us again. Thanks a million. Happy Black Friday to you.
Thanks.
Do you also love shopping?
No, I hate it. Absolutely hate it.
Even buying nonsense that you don't really, you know, that little dopamine hit that you get when you go, ah, I bought something, and then it arrives 3 weeks later and it sits in the box for 5 months afterwards.
I like buying stuff like that for myself. Like, I like buying books. And they're arriving mostly just for me, or buying stuff and it's for me. I don't like buying stuff for other people.
Okay.
Just, I don't get the kick that other people get. It's like just a hassle.
All right. OTBAM, live with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. We love charity. Owen, on the other hand, clearly doesn't.
Despises it.
Tomorrow, we're going to hear from Samuel Luckhurst of the Manchester Evening News. We're chatting to James Skell about that brilliant piece that was published on otbsports.com about him last Saturday by Arthur O'Dea.
OTB AM with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.